How would you like to become financially free with co-living real estate investment? Today we have Sam Wiegert. And what's so special about Sam is he's the co-living king and the number one authority in co-living real estate. And he started his co-living journey in 2011 and reached financial freedom with his wife by age 23. And what began with just a few rented rooms has grown into a network of over 1,500 co-living doors, including his own and those of the investors that he mentors. And as the founder of Scale Your Co-Living Real Estate and the largest co-living real estate mastermind in the world, Sam leads a thriving community of investors transforming traditional rentals into high-performing, affordable housing. So, Sam, tell us about how can entrepreneurs become financially free with co-living real estate investment?
Welcome to Awakened Titans Podcast with Lily Patrescu, mind-blowing conversations with influential business titans sharing how you can manifest abundance, love, joy, success through quantum awakening, quantum manifestation, quantum healing, quantum miracles, exponential business growth, and innovative products and services.
Yeah, thanks, Lily. Thanks for having me on. Super excited to do this podcast. You know, when I first started co-living and buying real estate, I think it's like anywhere in Europe or anywhere, but buying real estate is like a difficult thing to initially get into, right? And I just got into it because I wanted a place to live for myself and I didn't want to have to spend money on rent, right? And so going through that, and then I started to realize, wait, I have extra space in each one of these homes. I have extra space and I started renting out rooms in my homes, which is very popular in Europe, it's becoming more popular in the States. And I just started to realize, wait a second, if I start renting out rooms in this house, I can actually generate some income for myself. And so I call that like house hacking, where you're just living in a room and you're renting out the other rooms to make a little bit of income. But where it becomes co-living, where it becomes financial freedom, to answer your question, is when it really is when you don't live there anymore. And you start to think of a house as like a mini business. And part of the business is how many rooms can you rent in this house? And how many rooms can you rent? And how much income can you generate from this? So we would take a home and we would put three people in, and four people, and five, and six, and seven, and eight. And so we have eight or nine people sharing a home. And you end up doubling or tripling or sometimes even quadrupling the amount of rent you would normally be able to get. And at the same time, it's providing housing for people at a much lower cost than if they were just to go rent an apartment or things like that. So it really just increases the income and helps provide affordable housing. And that's kind of the beautiful win-win of this co-living model.
Thank you. I'm doing this exact strategy in London. I've been
Nice.
doing it for
Okay.
14 years. And
Nice.
what first I want to ask you, why do you call it co-living versus another term? Is it because it sounds more attractive as a term?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. I'm not 100% sure why we call it that, if I'm being honest. I think it's a term that just kind of started to gain popularity because, you know, people used to call these homes boarding houses in America, or they'd call them rooming houses. But at least in America, if someone says to you, "Oh, I live in a boarding house or a rooming house," the picture that you get in your brain is not very good. You think run down, you think smelly, you think nasty. You know, and nobody wants a boarding house or a rooming house in their neighborhood. So I think co-living is kind of like the new updated term that's like a little bit more hip and cool. And it's like, oh yeah, it's just adult professionals living together. And I think that's why people use it, is to get away from some of the other terms.
Thank you. And what we call the flat shares or house shares. So, first of all,
Nice.
how can someone make a decent income with co-living real estate investment? Because I find in London, a lot of people can make this strategy happen and can make a significant amount of money. But I would say where a lot of people get tripped up is with the ongoing regulations that the government kind of keeps putting in order to make sure that first tenants are not being taken advantage of. And so I'm wondering whether there were any specific things that you put in place in order to make this not only a great real estate investment strategy where investors can make a lot of money, but also keep up with the regulations that keep kind of becoming tighter and tighter and tighter.
And when you say the regulations, you mean more like, do you mean regulations on like how many people can live in a house, or are you talking more about regulations of just, oh, it's harder to kick people out, or it's more like tenant friendly? Is that what you mean?
Talking, for example, like the government in the UK has made it so that the room sizes have to be a certain size, and there has to be a living room, and I don't know, there are a lot of little things that have to be done. You have to have like fire doors. So you if you didn't have, let's say, fire doors, you would have to replace all the doors with fire doors. So I'm wondering whether there's anything in particular that you advise investors to do in the beginning so they don't have trouble in the future, so they kind of like create like a sustainable investment. Because I think if you were to invest in co-living real estate investment and then realize down the line that you had to like change all the fire doors, then all of a sudden your investment doesn't sound as great.
That's right. Yeah, in America it's a little bit different because it's still the Wild West here when it comes to co-living. There's not a lot of regulations. Cities and towns are still trying to understand it, and not everybody really understands it yet, right? And so there's not some of those same things. But I'll give a couple of tips that I think are valuable. When someone buys a home, well, first of all, I'll say this, and this is going to sound harsh, but like if you're, I'm going to speak to the investors that are listening to this. If someone is either a wannabe investor or an investor, you got to go put your money in places where you think it's going to be well done. So, like, I'll give you where it's actually going to get a good return. And what I mean by this is, for example, in America, every city in America right now is trying to regulate Airbnb because Airbnbs take housing off the market just for vacations. And so every city's like kicking Airbnbs out. So I tell people, don't invest in Airbnb. It's not the thing to invest in because there's so many regulations, there's so many places. So I don't know what the climate of for co-living is in UK. Like, I don't know how many regulations or what regulations, but I just know that, like, if you're an investor on this call, you might have to find a place that's friendly to co-living. There are some cities even in America that hate co-living, and I don't invest in those cities, right? I only invest in areas that are friendly. So money is going to follow where it's easier to do. That's just kind of the law of how it works. I'm not saying that that's good. I'm just saying that's kind of how it works. And if you're an investor, you want to think about all these things ahead of time. But one of the, so I would say, how friendly is the area that you want to invest in? Maybe the UK is friendly and maybe not. Maybe your money should go somewhere else and invest. I don't know. But I'm saying that if you're an investor listening to this, you should at least be thinking about that. The second thing I would say is whenever I go into a home and I convert it to a co-living home, because, Lily, we'll take sometimes a 4-bedroom home and convert it to an 8-bedroom home or a 9-bedroom home. And so, first of all, the way we're generating financial freedom is by really using all of the extra space in the home. And some people say, oh, Sam, that's terrible. You're just packing all these people in one home. But then when you think about it, even in the United States, we have 600,000 people that will be homeless in America tonight. We need the housing. It's a crazy, in Europe, same way. Like, there's a crisis around this. So I'm okay with taking all the extra space except for one common space, like you're saying, in the kitchen and making that, rooms. But I even when I do that conversion, in the back of my head, Lily, I'm always thinking, what if one day I had to turn this back into a single family home? What if one day I had to sell this as a single family home? And I think that's a way of me as an investor protecting, just in case in 10 years from now, the United States comes out with crazy regulation and I can't do co-living anymore. Okay, great. I can still turn this back into a single family home, sell it, make money, and move on to something else, right? You need to be thinking. Good investors are not super optimistic. The best investors have a little bit of pessimism. They're thinking about the downside. So I love that you asked that question. And those are a couple of things that I would recommend for people is, think about, hey, do you really want to be in an area with a lot of regulation for it? Right? That's why I'm not doing Airbnb in America, because there's a lot of regulation for it. I don't want to do that here at least. Right. And then also be thinking about kind of planning ahead of, well, what happens if you had to convert? I think good investors have option A. Good investors then have an option B, and they have a plan C. They have a couple of things. And I think every house, you need to go into it thinking about it from that perspective.
Thank you. Then tell me about the investment part. Is it that the model is that the investor would buy the property and then turn it into an HMO, like a house of multiple occupation? Or is it that the investor would just re-rent from the landlord and just bag the profit?
Look, I think it's getting harder and harder and harder in almost all Western countries to own real estate. It's getting more expensive. Interest rates are rising, all this crazy stuff, right? However, I do believe that the people who will get left behind, and I say left behind financially in an economy, and all Western economies right now are facing inflation, are the people who don't own things. So one of my passions, one of my missions for even teaching other investors about this is because I believe every single person should do whatever it takes to try to actually own assets. And the reason for that, Lily, is because when there's inflation in an economy, assets always rise to match inflation, right? Incomes don't always rise, but assets do. So my homes have doubled in value. Some have tripled in value. But that's because it's not because they're like the most amazing houses in the most amazing cities. It's because we've printed a lot of money and a lot of economies are facing that. And so I say that to say, yes, I'm not a big fan of renting and re-renting. There are so many benefits to owning real estate. Now, it's hard. It's difficult. But if you have the right passion and you're dedicated to it, anybody can own a home, right? You may have to partner. You may have to raise some capital because you don't have the capital. You might have to partner with someone that can get a better loan than you. There's all kinds of ways to do it. But I don't want people to get left behind. And I think you need to own stuff, real assets, real hard assets in order to do that. So I'm a big fan of, this is what I coach hundreds of investors through. Let's get your first home. Let's get your second home. Let's go. Let's turn it into a co-living property and have a cash flow thousands of dollars a month from you to create some financial freedom. Because there's other benefits. I don't know in the UK if there's tax benefits to owning real estate, but in America, there's amazing tax benefits to owning real estate. Amazing. You pay less in taxes because you own real estate. You get to pay down these mortgages over time. So you wake up 10 years later and you're like, oh my gosh, I paid down this house so much. I paid down the mortgage. I paid down the principal of the mortgage. And then property values go up in value as inflation and property values get more scarce. So there's just so many benefits to owning it that I'm sold everybody should own a piece of real estate, at least one.
Thank you. Tell us about the 10 commandments of creating a sustainable co-living real estate investment business. And what I mean by that, okay, for example, is it that you create the co-living spaces that look luxury? Is it that they are not so luxury, they're more like practical IKEA type kind of furniture? Is it that they all have like studios, or is it that they all have their own bathroom and their own TV and so on? Are there certain luxuries or certain, yeah, you can say, items that every single room has that makes your properties so valuable that they go off the market really fast once you get them to rent? So tell us your 10 commandments.
Yeah, no, I can give you some great tips there. I think the three most important things that people need to think about when they're going to do a co-living home is you need to have some systems to keep the homes clean, to keep them quiet, and to keep them safe. So clean could be, we have professional cleaners come in once or twice per month to clean the house. Right? That's one of our strategies. Another system that we use is, you know, people pitching in to actually help, like almost like a chore list, where once every month they pitch in and they do some chores, right? That's really important. Clean could be just having a house rule that says no common areas in the common space. No personal items, excuse me, no personal items in the common space. So you use your laptop, you use your book bag, use your whatever, put it right back in your room when you're done. That's really important to doing this well. So we have clean, quiet. Quiet is very important. Having quiet hours. People need to come home and feel like it's home, not feel like it's a party, right? We restrict the number of overnight guests that come over because we don't want it to be a constant like hotel with people just constantly coming in and coming in, right? So that's one of our rules that we have. And we have other house rules that just keep people really safe, right? So safety is the third thing you got to do. So it might be for us, it's keyless entry locks on the front door, keyless entry locks on the bedroom door. We have cameras in the common space. We don't have cameras anywhere where there's an expectation of privacy, but cameras in the common space, but cameras around the home, lights that turn automatically, just thinking those things through. If you can do clean and quiet and safe, you can really scale co-living. But I will say that most people who live in a co-living home, most people who rent a room instead of an apartment, to a large extent, it's economically driven. What that means is they can afford a room, but they may not want to or even can afford a studio apartment or a two-bedroom apartment or a one-bedroom apartment. So they're doing this for economic reasons. So a lot of times you're not looking for luxury. I know you mentioned luxury. For us, and I'm not saying you can't do luxury. Some people do. It's just not the model that I think actually works the best. This is for people who are frankly working professionals. This is not college students, not people going to university. This is people who are, they have a job, but they're just not making enough money to after taxes to afford what they want to be able to afford. And so, or maybe they're just trying to save. Maybe they're going through a year or 2 years where they're trying to save a bunch of money, or they're sending a bunch of money to their family, or they're supporting somebody else. Like, these are really important things. And so I think the economically driven piece, you know, for us, there's a couple of other things I would say is just like, so no frills, right? We don't do pools. We don't do hot tubs. We don't do cold plunges. We don't do saunas. It's just basic housing. I don't even furnish the bedrooms. And the reason for that is actually it was someone in Germany called me up one day and he said, Sam, I know co-living is new to America, but we've been living like this for a long time in Europe. He said, actually, I believe the room is the new apartment. Like that's how people think about it. And I said, man, if the room is the new apartment, I want people to think of the room like an apartment. I don't want it to be furnished. I don't want it to have a short-term rental feel. I want it to be like, move your stuff in, live here. This is home. I lived in co-living homes for 13 and a half years. When my wife met me, I had 7 roommates, right? So it's like, I know what it's like to have that, but I lived in these for a long time and I had housemates that lived for a long time. So I want people to think of this as home. And I think people will think about it more as home if they get to move their own stuff into the room. That's my take. That's my philosophy anyway. You want to make sure it has, you want to be in an area, you know, in America, we have these things called HOAs. They're like little mini governments, like in a city. And you want to be outside of those if you can. You don't want to be subject to more rules than you have to be. We always think through parking, or are you close to public transportation, right? And whenever you buy a home, of course, you want to look at, are there things in this home that are going to go bad really soon? Is the HVAC, like the air con and the heat, is that going to be dead soon where I have to put a lot of money into replacing it? You know, is the home updated? Is it new? You do want it to be a good, solid construction home. So I could go on, but hopefully that gives your listeners a few things to think about when they're thinking about their first co-living home. Close to public transportation is obviously much better, or having enough room for parking is obviously much better. And every city is a little bit different, but you want to make sure that you thought through everything. Now, we do furnish the common areas. I think that's really important. We furnish the kitchen, we furnish the living room, and we make it like really nice as we can. So people walk in and go, oh, this is cozy. This is cute. This is nice. And I think that's really important too. You could walk into any of our homes and you would think they're like very nice Airbnbs, but they're not. They're long-term stays, but they have that feel, that really nice feel to them.
Thank you. I'm actually very surprised that you offer unfurnished bedrooms, because, for example, in London, I'm not sure you could get away with that, because I think especially before Brexit, I'm not sure if you know what Brexit is, but when, you know, Britain left the EU.
Yes.
I mean, I had such a massive influx of people like from France. They would come in for a weekend and then they would be like, oh, I'm looking for a job. And then, you know, if I can get a job, then I could be here 6 months or a year or whatever, you know. And a lot of times I would do something that most rental agents wouldn't do, which is that I would rent them a place for the longer term and I would help them find a job as well. But basically the room had to be fully furnished, and not just furnished, but it had to have bedding as well. And I would make it as cozy as possible, like including like some flower or painting or something to make them feel like the, you know, it's like an Airbnb type thing. Although it wasn't an Airbnb. I wasn't renting for 2 days. I was renting for 6 months, you know, on the basis that they would be able to do that, because I knew I could help them find a job within 15 minutes to 2 weeks max based on the kind of skills that they had.
That's awesome.
So I would like redo their CV and so on. Anyway, I'm talking irrelevant stuff now for your
thing. Cool,
I am surprised.
I want to say that I actually don't think that's that irrelevant, because I think like anything you can do in a co-living home to create like community. And it sounds like you've got some skills. So you're coming in and you're helping them like integrate into the community. I think that's brilliant. We are trying to do more of that, because when people feel that you care for them, obviously, like they're going to stay a lot longer and be a better member. So I think that's brilliant what you're doing. I think that's really sweet.
Thank you. I'm wondering about what kind of luxuries, what I mean by luxuries, like what kind of things do you find your tenants feel most attracted to in the co-living space, in the, let's say, communal area and kitchen, that kind of gets them to stay? And I would think, for example, in our kind of like apartments, the thing I noticed is, let's say, having a Henry Hoover is a very practical thing that like works so well, and it's like not heavy, and it's like so useful, and it's a little bit fun as well. I find that, you know, having a kettle and you know, a microwave and all these different things that kind of get you to feel like settled in, like you have your necessities, you know. So tell us a bit more about the necessities that or the things that you can say get your tenants most attracted to your properties? Is it that although perhaps the property is not luxury, do you give it like a luxury feel in terms of perhaps really nice bedding in the, or really nice sofa in the living, you know, living area, or a TV, or is what kind of things do you feel make your co-living spaces really attractive to tenants?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I also want to say one thing really fast before I answer that question of like about what you were saying about furnishing the rooms versus non-furnishing. And I think it's so important that you know who your clientele is and what they need. You know, I think that's really important. And every city is going to vary a little bit. For a while, we actually offered furnishings, but it was like, if they wanted it, we'd come in and bring it kind of thing. And so you can do the non-furnished furnished ops. We'd upcharge if they wanted furniture. So I love that you're doing that. And I think some people do that very, very, very successfully. So I would say that as far as the luxuries go, I mean, for us, yeah, luxury is such an interesting word because I would say that we can almost like shy away from luxury. But I think for us, you know, proximity, like where the house is located, is by far one of the most important things. Like, is it located close to employers? Like, even if it's not as nice of a house, if it's close to where a lot of people work, then a lot of the employees are going to want to come live there because it's close. So for us, like closeness and proximity is honestly what I think our people look for the most. I think also proximity to public transportation if they don't have their own car. In the cities that we're in, you kind of either like need a car or you need a bus or you need a train. And like if you're not close to, you know, if you don't have a car and you're not close to a bus stop and you're not close to a train, that is something that people will be like, okay, I'm going to move on to another house. But I think once you get into the house, I think just having a homey feel is the word I would use, like a homey feel, like it feels cozy. I feel like when people walk in and it smells clean is really important. So having just maybe the air fresheners or something like that around is important. We give all of our members when they move in just like a welcome packet that includes like some toilet paper, some trash bags, a trash can, you know, our manual of rules and things like that. So a lot of that is really important and I think makes people feel at home. And I know we mentioned clean already, but clean is important. That's like a luxury. Like, oh, wow, this place is not, there's seven people living here and it's not crazy dirty. There aren't dishes everywhere. It doesn't stink. And when we put things in the, when we do furnish the common area, we do it very nicely. You know, but usually we try to stay away from sofas just because we don't want people like sleeping on the couch. We'll do like high top tables, kind of a coffee bar kind of a theme, and we'll put everything they need in the kitchen, knives and silverware and cups and plates and just all the basics needed to come in and not have anything on your of your own and just live. Obviously they do need to furnish their room, at least in our model, but you know, kitchen is all taken care of. We do these Edison lights. We call them Edison lights. They're these little like lights that look really have a nice ambiance. And we always try to do like one outdoor area, whether it's a little fire pit or games. We'll put board games in Monopoly or chess or checker. Like we'll put these different things so that people, we don't put TVs in the common space because we want to keep the noise down and people can have a TV in their room, but we will do board games and anything where we feel like brings people together to connect them. So those are a few of the things that we do right now. It's a good question.
Thank you. What's the best way to keep harmony in the flat in terms of like them actually maintaining cleanliness and them also not kind of like bothering you at different hours because they don't know how to, I don't know, turn on the shower or whatever? Is it that the booklet that you're offering is comprehensive enough in order to set the rules? And typically clients tend to be relatively mature. They don't need a lot of babysitting, because one thing I have found is that I haven't yet had any clients that don't need babysitting when it comes to real, you know, co-living real estate investment projects. What I find is sometimes I get these messages because we have like a WhatsApp group where we keep in touch and people can write me at any time.
Yes.
And sometimes I see a picture of, oh, this guy only cooked a potato in the oven today. And it's like, I'm thinking, you're 40, like you shouldn't be messaging about that. Like you should be able to just knock on the door of Pedro and just tell him, you know, like if it bothers you that he only cooked one potato, like,
yes.
I don't understand like how this is even relevant to me, you know? So I'm wondering, what do you do to kind of make sure that there is a harmonious environment so that they can stay for long periods of time in the
Yes.
property.
Yeah, it's so true. I remember we call these peanut butter problems. It's like Johnny, in room two calls you and starts complaining about Susie in room four that he ate her peanut butter because he left it out on the kitchen table. And you're like, I don't know if I want to deal with these problems, right? Like, this is not the problems I want to deal with. But there are a lot of things that we put in place. I think the first step to having a harmonious household is the foundation that you build the house on. And I don't mean like the physical foundation. I mean, how are you vetting? How are you interviewing the people who come in? And we have a very strict process. Like, for example, last month, I think I want to say we filled 35 rooms last month in the month of October. But we had over 600 people reach out to us in terms of like they reached out and said, hey, I'm interested to rent a room. So that's a big difference, right? So we're interviewing them and making them kind of, we call it jump, making them jump through some fiery hoops. We're kind of making it a little bit difficult. Like if someone reaches out and says, I want to rent a room, we don't just go, yay, like come on in. We're like, hey, have you ever lived in co-living before? Please watch this little video about what co-living is about. And then if you still want to, then reach back out to us. So you can see we're almost like putting roadblocks in their way. And if they still are like, okay, I understand co-living, that makes sense. We send them a little. And by the way, that is one thing that I would recommend everybody do. If you have a co-living home, and I can even share it with you later, Lily, but we have this little video that's so well done that says, this is what co-living is and here's the rules. But it's like fun to watch. It's like one of those little whiteboard videos where the animation draws things out. So it's like fun to watch and engaging. And at the end, you're like, oh, wow, like they explained co-living really well. They explained what not to do in co-living, what to do in co-living, what it's about, who it's a good fit for, who it's not a good fit for, right? If you're really particular and you want all your stuff always in the same place in the common area, you're like, don't come. This is not for you. So I think I always try to get people to put a little bit more effort on the front end so they don't have to put a lot of effort on the back end, which is what you're saying of like, ah, now granted, it still happens. Like even it still happens. You can put all the effort you want on the front end, you're still gonna have some back end effort. But that's very important. Then we meet them in person. We give them a tour of the home virtually or in person. Then we call it a vibe check. We're like, hey, are they going to be a good fit for this home? Then we have them fill out an application and we check their financials and we check their credit and we check their background and make sure they're not a violent criminal. Like there's a lot of little steps that go into before they move in. And the more you can do of that, the better. But once they do move in and you have those issues, yeah, then what we've done is we've been doing this for now. I bought my first co-living home in 2011. So almost a decade and a half, almost 15 years. And in those 15 years, I've seen it. I don't want to say I've seen it all because every time I say I've seen it all, something happens that I've never seen before. I've had someone die in a home before, not because he got killed, but just because he passed away. Thankfully, that's something I haven't seen yet. I've seen someone pass away in a home. May he rest in peace. I've seen, people obviously smoking homes. I've seen people bring guns into the home. I've seen people have five kids living with them. And like, I've seen it all. And so what we do is we just have created what we call a operating procedure, an SOP, a standard operating procedure for every situation. And we have this huge document. So it's like, okay, for example, someone's smoking in the home and it's like very against our rules to smoke in the home. Someone's smoking marijuana in the home. Okay, we're gonna send that person one warning. Here's the script. We already read it out. This is what I help my students with. Here's the script. Doom, copy, paste, send them a text. Oh, it's happening again. And we know it's happening because someone else will complain. And so sometimes someone else complaining is actually a good thing. Or we'll see it on the cameras that are in the common area. Up the second time we send them a fine. Hey, you're getting fined $250. This is definitely against the rule. In our leases, in our membership agreements that we use, we can fine them for breaking the house rules. Fine. Oh, I don't want to pay the fine. I'm not going to pay. That's terrible. That's stupid. Fine. Then we're terminating your membership and we're going to remove you from the property effective immediately. Like, we kind of do this like three strikes and you're out, which is kind of an American baseball thing, but like three strikes and you're out. Like you're going to get a warning, a fine. And then if it happens again, you're out of the house. Like, because you have to protect the culture of the house. I can't tell you how many times we've had one bad person in a house of eight people. And we let that one bad person stay and five people leave because they're like, I don't want to live with this person. This person is absent. So you got to get the one bad person out quickly. And I don't know the legalities of how to do that in the UK and America. Depending on what state you're in, it can be easy, it can be hard. But there are some legal things that I probably won't talk about today because I'm not sure it's relevant. But there are some legal things. You want to make sure you're structured legally really well so you can get people out as fast as possible if they break some of the house rules. And in America, that's pretty easy to do, thankfully, so far.
Thank you. How do you manage behavioral issues that impact the cleanliness of the home? For example, one issue that I'm still dealing with is people leaving hair in the shower and people, let's say, washing their dishes and leaving the actual food in sink, or maybe not flushing the toilet well, or leaving marks when they, you know, use the toilet or things like that. Small little things that, you know, if you're an ultra clean person and living with an, yes, not ultra dirty necessarily, I haven't had ultra dirty, but, you know, somewhere along the edge of, I can't be bothered to kind of do this little thing that will make a big difference to, you know, to the co-living situation. What would you put in place to make sure that this doesn't impact the your real estate investment? Because what I found, okay, is like you said, sometimes you have four really great tenants, very clean, very organized, quiet, everything. Then you have one person that is disturbing the entire thing. But the things happen in the UK, for example, especially after Brexit, what we've noticed is that, let's say four, we used to have a major influx of especially like French, Spanish, Romanian, Italian people that would come frequently, even during the summer. So it was very easy to replace a tenant if you had to, let's say, give the warnings to one tenant that was bad, let's say. You could choose someone else. But now what I found is that the best thing is to rent your property out in September, at least for 1 year. And then you can get another good tenant in September. So you either have to like live with whoever you chose for like 1 year. Or if you kick someone out in March, it will be hard and you will have to rent it out a lot cheaper. So tell us about what kind of things that you put in place for this.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing that comes to my mind is like, I definitely think when you're in the co-living business like you are, there is a whole conversation that we probably don't have time for on just how are you marketing your property? Because I'll be honest, we have 2,500 rooms, not me personally, I own a few hundred, but like in our group, we have 2,500 rooms all around the United States. And so for us, it's like, okay, that's a decent number of rooms. We have to keep them full. How do we keep them full? And we've noticed that we can do little things. We can advertise in different places. We can do little specials. And so then the conversation becomes like, are we advertising enough? Are we marketing well? And so that's a whole conversation too, to like, because I want leads throughout every day, every month, I have to, otherwise these places sit empty like you're talking about, which is not fun. But So your original question was just, what do we do to kind of keep people in? I'm sorry, I kind of forgot the original question.
What do you do to deal with behavioral issues related to cleanliness? Where, let's say, you're not going to be able to kick out the person at least until September.
Yeah.
And perhaps it's already, let's say, November, and you know you have to still deal with them for at least another 9 months or so. So what do you do?
You know, what I've learned in this business is that you can make any rule you want. You can say, hey, you have to clean up your dishes after you use them. You have to clean out the microwave after you use, like, you can make any rule you want, but rules only really get followed if there are consequences. And that is just what I have found. I'm not saying some people won't. Obviously some great people will follow the rules even if they're no's, but you have to have some consequences that you have told them in advance before they moved in. You can't spring it on them once they move in. Like, oh, by the way, there's $100 fine every time I look at the camera and I don't see that you did your dishes and I see you were the one that used them and now I'm charging you $100, like whatever it is. Like, you can't spring that on them. It has to be very clear from the beginning. And so that's the system we use. The system we use is, hey, here are the rules. And the rules are all probably similar to the right. No weapons, no this, no, you wash your dishes with it right away as soon as you use them or put them in the dishwasher. Like having all the rules you want to have in your home, giving that to them in advance, and then saying, hey, you need to initial every one of these rules so I know you read it and I know you understand. And at the bottom, it's just going to be real big, bold, where they sign. It's going to say, hey, we have the ability to charge your rental account X number of dollars on one. And it's hard to do because like people be like, oh, I don't want to pay. But as long as it's communicated up front and you still maybe give them one warning and then you charge them, that's what you got to do. And I would still say, I would still say that even if, you know, it's hard to fill in the middle of the year or whatever, there is sometimes where you still need to kick someone out. Like, because it's more harm to the people who are there. Maybe they won't renew now, or maybe they will leave because of that or something like that. At least that's what we found. Maybe in your area it's different. But so I would say do the work on the front end. Be very clear about your expectations and what the rules are. Most people that run into these problems, I feel like either A, don't have any consequences, or B, they weren't clear about them at the beginning. Right. But for us, we're very clear about them. And if someone doesn't clean at all, like right now, they have to clean. They have to help with the chore list. If they just say, I don't want to help with the chore list, great. It's $50 extra a month. We're going to hire a cleaner. They're going to come in and do your week. That's just how we do it. And we charge their account for it. So they can do it or they cannot do it. But if they don't do it, there's got to be some sort of consequence.
Thank you. I actually also have like an penalties for different things.
Yes.
The reality is I don't actually enforce them. And I have tried enforcing them in the past. And what I have found is it was especially when they weren't washing their dishes.
Yes.
And it was like a minor penalty, like £50 if you don't wash your dishes. And
yes.
It wouldn't be that, oh, one time someone didn't wash their dish and I would like try to. No, it was like if I was getting like a repeated thing where repeated complaint from another tenant that, okay, this person isn't washing their dishes. And, you know, then that's when I would try to enforce it. But what I noticed is imagine doing that around December and then you're going to be empty. So it's like,
because
it's
people will
a,
move out.
Yeah, they will move out because let's say either they will not pay that, or let's say if they do pay it, then they get upset and they feel unwelcome. They feel like their house is not a home anymore and they will leave with month notice or lose.
I think you know, you can give them a warning, you can give them two warnings, but at some point, unless you're just willing to have dirty dishes everywhere, which in my opinion, that's going to probably have. If I have dirty dishes in the sink every time I go to show the place or every time everybody else comes in, I'm going to lose at least two people. Like if that's every time, right? And there's a tolerance level of what's acceptable and what's not. But so for me, and dishes is maybe not a great example because that's a minor thing, but let's say smoking is probably a bigger one for us, like someone's smoking. And if I don't kick that person out or I don't find them and I don't enforce it, oh, I'm definitely losing two of the good people. Two of the good people. Like, it's like, I it sucks either way, but I have to trade one because I didn't vet him well enough, but I've got to trade one for two. Like that's how I think about it is like, dang it. It sucks. It's bad. It's terrible. But what's the consequences if I do not let this person go? And if you can ask that question and say, oh shoot. But if you ask the question like, nobody cares. I'm not going to lose anybody else. Then like, cool. Maybe you let them stay. Like maybe that's your decision. I'm just gonna let them stay and have dirty dishes like that. I don't think I'm gonna lose anybody. But with our homes here, if we let some of that bad behavior go on, then other people start to do it. Then it starts to become a downward spiral. And now I'm losing two or three of my best people in that home. And they're just like, hey, we were really good tenants. We were really good. But like John is filling the house with smoke every day and you're not doing anything about it. I'm gone. Peace. And it's like, oh, okay. So you got to take a little hit to avoid a big hit. That's what I think. That's what I've learned. That's what I think.
Thank you. Tell us about the types of mortgage that you would have to have in order to be able to do a co-living real estate investment.
You know, yeah, I was going to ask you about this actually. In UK, do you guys have like 40-year mortgages or no? Do you have that?
I'm
Is
not
that a
aware
thing?
Of 40-year mortgages.
Okay.
But I am aware of 30.
We have 30. 30 is very popular here. Donald Trump just came out and said he's going to try to work on a 50-year mortgage for everybody. So as you might imagine, if they go to a 50-year mortgage, that's going to make real estate just jump in price so much because people are going to be working on buying because people buy the monthly cost of the property. They don't care how much it is. They care what's it cost me monthly, usually. So we'll see how that actually goes. But anyway, all that is to say is, you know, there's all kinds of different mortgages. I don't know if they're very much the same in the UK, though. Were you going to say something about that?
Yeah, I was going to say, because I think that to be able to do co-living in the UK, you have to have like an HMO mortgage. And I'm wondering whether you need to have a particular type of mortgage in order to do co-living.
No, I didn't know that about the UK. Here, no, you don't need any particular kind of mortgage. You can even, you know, one of the best strategies in the United States right now that I encourage people who are just starting to do is to go buy the home as your primary residence. Because in America, if you buy it as your primary residence, you get like, you only have to put like 3% down or 5% down. So it's very low. And you get a really great interest rate. It's like the best mortgage in the whole world kind of thing. And then you're supposed to, you sign a paper that says, I will live in it for 1 year. But you can live in it. Like, this is how I bought my first six houses. I lived in it for 1 year and then I went and bought another one and I got the same 5% down. And then I lived in it for 1 year and bought another one. And, you know, every 6 years I've got six houses, like with little amounts of money out of my pocket. So that is a, and then once you leave the house, the banks don't care. As long as you're still paying your mortgage, they don't care what you do with it. You can turn it into an Airbnb, turn it into a co-living, turn it into whatever you want. They don't care as long as they're still getting their money. So in America, it's a little bit more relaxed about that here. And so that strategy of just buying your home and then turning to co-living, but that's what I recommend for people to get actually get started. It's so easy.
Thank you. What are the worst mistakes you've seen people do when trying to become financially free with co-living real estate investment?
Yeah, one of the big ones that I see a lot of my students doing now, and I'm trying to stop them from doing this, is they're buying in like multiple, they'll be like, oh, I got my first home in Charlotte, North Carolina. And they'll be like, I'm going to buy my second home in a completely different city. And I'm like, no, like you really want to have, if you're going to do one or two or three homes, you want to have your homes in one area. You don't want to spread them out over a big area. Is you just get, it makes it easier to maintain them, easier to get members, easier to put a little bit of money into some marketing because you've got more, you know, in that area, easier to get someone to manage it down the road. If you don't want to manage it, you want to have to hire a manager because they're all in one area. So that's one big mistake I see. Another mistake that I see a lot of people make is just, they don't have the right systems to run the house. Kind of like we've been talking about this whole podcast. Like they don't have the right systems. They don't have anything for clean. They don't have cleaners. They don't have the right house rules, or they have them, but they don't enforce them. One of my first ever students bought his home. He bought it like 3,000 miles away from where he lived. So we'd like across the nation. And he just thought he would just rent these rooms and everything would work perfect. Well, pretty soon he had no cameras. He didn't have these door locks. He didn't have systems. He didn't have the cleaning checklist in place. He didn't have anything. And sure enough, within like 3 months, 4 months, he had kids that weren't supposed to live there, living in there. He had one person who was like kicking everybody else out and one person smoking, one person, and it was a mess. So co-living, the hardest part I think about co-living, Lily, is what you shared earlier. The hardest part I think is, especially with us when you have eight people or nine, we have a big home. We have some big homes. We have some homes that are 11 people sharing a home. So the hardest part is, how do you manage it? What are those systems, the decisions you were talking about that are just tough decisions? Who do I kick out? When do I let them stay? When do I fine them? And when do I just give them a warning? When, like, that's the hardest part of this game. But if you can crack that code, if you can do that, then the rest, in my opinion, is easier than that.
Thank you. Tell us more about the keys, you know, the keyless entry and the cameras. First of all, yeah. I'm not sure, is it legal to have cameras inside the home, which I understood is not in the room, it's just in the communal areas. Is it legal to have that? And
yeah,
secondly,
it is.
For the keyless entry, is it easy to have them monitor? Because what I'm afraid of is, let's say once I install those, let's say someone gets, what do you call it, isn't able to access, what am I going to be able to do from like miles away, you know, from like a different country? So is it easy to kind of monitor those and to provide access in case that anything kind of breaks when it comes to the locks?
Yeah, the cameras are legal, at least in America, but you can't put them in any place where there's an expectation of privacy. And we let them know that they're there, and it's in their membership agreement that they signed. Like, hey, just so you know, there are common, you know, again, so much of this co-living game is telling them in advance, setting expectations correctly. So we let them know in advance, like, hey, there's going to be a camera in the common area. They have to sign that, right? So they know. So that's number one. Number two, the keyless entry, the ones that we use are these, they're called Sifly, S-I-F, Sifly, Sifly. I think that's how you spell it. And they are digital and they are remote, means they connect to Wi-Fi and you can see every person that comes in. Some of them even have cameras on the front of the lock, so you can see who's coming in. We use those for the front doors of the main house, so people, I can see who's coming in. But they're very powerful. Now do they sometimes, and then what's also great about those is they will give you a battery life. So they'll tell you, hey, this has 20% less. So you know in advance, because a lot of problems that we had earlier were with these locks and the batteries would die. And we would have no way of knowing because then someone tries to get in at 3 a.m. in the morning and they're calling you because they're locked out of their room. So for us, these just work very well from that standpoint. I can change the code remotely online. I can see where the battery life is. I can see if it's having any issues online. I can see that it's functioning correctly online. I can see if it's opened or closed online. I can see how many times it's been opened that day online. Like, everything's recorded. So I'm a huge fan of the keyless entry locks. I don't even know how we did this before we had those. Now, every once in a while, there will still be something will break or whatever. And then you're just going to have that with this business. You're going to have a couple times a year, a lock is going to break and they're going to call you, or they're going to bust their door down to try to get into their room, you know, something crazy like that. And you just got to deal with that as best you can. But I still think the benefits of these particular locks really outweigh any of the downsides.
Wow. So, yes. So at the moment, I have actual keys, and I have been thinking about changing them. I'm talking about the main entrance, the rooms actually have like a keypad thing, but it's not nice. Changeable, and I find that to be a hassle, you know. Were there any other things?
Check out Sifly. And then they're the best locks. We use them in all of our homes. They're amazing, and the batteries last a long time too.
Thank you. Are there any last little things you want to share about becoming financially free with co-living real estate investment?
No, I think the last thing I would share is that people listening to this podcast, maybe if you're not already in real estate, you may be thinking, damn, that's a lot of work. There's a lot of nuances. There's a lot of details. And sometimes that can be overwhelming. But I do want to say that I truly believe, otherwise I wouldn't be here, that the benefits outweigh the negatives. Tremendously. Getting into real estate and owning real estate used to be something that was only for the extremely wealthy, the barons, the lords. They were the only ones that owned the land. But it's not that way anymore. One of the great advances, I think, of Western society is that it truly is possible for anybody to own a piece of land and own property, right? That used to be something very exclusive hundreds and hundreds and thousands of years ago. And so now it's just important that we all are taking advantage of that so that we can pass on wealth to our family, so we can leave something to our family. And almost all insanely wealthy people own some real estate because they realize how stable and secure it is as an investment. And so my encouragement to anybody listening to this as a final thing is just, it may seem overwhelming at first, but continue to learn. Don't get left behind as inflation continues. You need to own something that's going to go up in value as inflation continues. And so get started somewhere, whether that's listening to Lily or training with Lily or coming to, you know, I do these free online courses that people can just come and learn a lot about co-living. If you're interested in doing that, please come and we'll do. And that's kind of what I would want to share.
Thank you. Are there any standard operating procedures that you use for receiving payments on time from renters?
There's so many softwares out there. I mean, there's so many. There's one called DoorLoop that we have used. There's one called AppFolio that we use. And I'm sure every country has their own, but like there's usually a million of those. You just want to make sure that it can be used for rooms too. But a lot of these softwares, what we'll do is we'll set up a house, like a multifamily building, and then just call each room like a different number, almost like it's like a 8-unit multifamily, but really it's an 8-unit single family home. You know, sometimes we'll do stuff like that just to make it easier on the software. But yeah, any of these softwares can track that and can send notices and do all of that. That's no problem.
Thank you. I'm talking more about making sure that actually you get paid, as opposed to, let's say, tenants not paying you for like many months. And I didn't understand that you made a lot of research on every client and chose the very best of the very best.
Yes.
In the off chance that, let's say, a person Someone that normally pay. Has been paying really well for 5 years and all of a sudden they're out of a job because of an extenuating circumstance.
Yes.
What happens there?
Yeah, I mean, it's important to have an SOP around that. For us, I mean, if someone's been paying for that long, we would definitely try to give them grace and try to work with them, especially if it was like a job loss or something like that. Sometimes we'll even try to help them find another place that's not our home, that's cheaper, or that they can live for free for a while. Like, we'll even go so far as to do that. So the more stuff you can do like that is good. But if someone is not paying and they're being mean about it, then yeah, in America, depending on what state you're in, it's pretty simple. You give them a notice. And if they don't pay by the date of that notice, then you take them to court And if they don't pay by that, then you get an eviction date. And if they don't leave by that date, the police come and remove them. It is that simple. And that can take 30 to 45 or even sometimes 2 months. But it depends. You know, a lot of times we don't try to evict someone if they're communicating with us. And if we feel like there's where we go to evictions is when someone's just super mean or cold or angry or they're not responding to us. It's like, okay, well, we've got to get the room back because we've got to rent it to someone else. So yeah, you need to have a good procedures around that. But we do evict. I mean, if we need to, we'll kick someone out of a room, and it's a fairly easy process once you do it a couple of times.
Thank you. What are the best things you've put in place to make sure that tenants love staying there? So that, let's say you have a tenant that comes in and stays 1 year, how do you make sure that that tenant perhaps renews for another 3, 4, 5 years so that you have a sustainable investment? Because what I've discovered is that if a tenant ends up staying 5 years, then the hassle is like so reduced. Because
yes.
instead of like renting out 5 rooms every September in one place, let's say, you will be renting only one because that's the only one that left.
Yeah.
Is there anything you put
Yeah.
in place to make sure that your home becomes almost like addictive? No, I'm not sure if addictive is the right word. It becomes such a homely, such a lovely, exciting
Yeah.
place to live.
Yeah, I think for us, we're still experimenting with this, honestly. You know, we've talked about giving them some bonus, like even paying, because it is, it's such a great thing when they stay and they renew and they keep going that like, we've even thought about what if we paid them some money? We said, hey, or what if their rent actually went down a little bit every year? Like we haven't implemented this, but we're experimenting and trying some of these things. But I would say, you know, things that we have done that can work is just honestly making sure that people get along. And I think we've talked a lot in this episode about kicking out the bad people. Honestly, that's a huge one because the good people are not going to stay with someone that's belligerent or angry or being loud every night or bringing over guests every night. Like good people won't stay around for that. So I think that's part of the key. We do some community events. We'll do pizza nights and send everybody pizza for free, send them food. We'll do certain things to just try to create community. We'll host parties for people. Like that type of stuff is really important. But ultimately, I think it boils down to when they have a concern, do you respond in a timely manner? And when they have a maintenance issue, do you take care of it in a timely manner? I mean, honestly, I've found that those are some of the biggest things that keep people around because they feel like you care. And the rest are things that are going to be beyond your control. Job loss, they need to move, their family comes in, stuff like that. So there's only so much you can do there, but those are a few of my thoughts.
Thank you. What about your client avatar? Have you discovered that there is a client avatar in terms of age and job that tends to be like your ideal client? Because for me, what I have discovered is that for a really long time, I seemed to attract people in the 20 to 30 age range. And I noticed that they were leaving every 6 months to a year. Yeah, some of them were staying 2 years. But now I'm attracting more the 35 to 45 range. And these are the kind of people who are like I had people saying, can I stay the next 3 years? And I'm like, yeah, I
Yeah.
think you can. So is there any particular client avatar that you find is the most exciting to have in your homes? Exciting, I'm not sure if that's the right word, but you know, the most suitable for your homes.
Yeah, I think for me, I think for us, we definitely had that same thing, like the younger crowd. For us, the biggest thing is just like, do they have a good job? Are they there in that area? And do they plan on staying there for a while? I think that's even more important than age for us is like, what's their employment? Are they a college student that's going to move around, or are they actually like they're planning to make this a home? So I think trying to, on the front end, trying to identify what are their intentions? I think that's really important. And if you have their intentions or no, I'm going to be here, or I've got this job, but then I'm going to move here, then it's like, oh, that might not be the best client for you to put in your home. But we found, yeah, but we have a lot of people like 55 years and older. Honestly. So I think it's just a matter of, but we've had some younger people stay for a long time too. So I don't know if for us, age is really the determining factor. I think it's more about what are their intentions? What's their job situation? What's their family situation? And just do they plan on staying here for a long time? So those are some questions I would ask people on the front end for sure. And because you want, if you have two people that want a room and one's planning to stay for 3 months or 6 months and one's like, no, I could see myself living here for 4 years, well, I'm going to probably go with the person that's wants to stay for a long time. I might even give that person a little less discount on rent because I really want that type of person, you know?
Thank you. Tell us where entrepreneurs can connect with you.
Yeah, if people are interested to learn more about co-living, obviously, you know, listening to you and what you're sharing is so valuable. And then just, I do these free trainings every once in a while, every month. It's www.scaleyourrealestate.com. If they go to www.scaleyourrealestate.com, they can get registered for a training, one of my free trainings where I deep dive in. Or if they want to follow me on Instagram at Sam Wiegert, that's another way to do it as well. I share a lot of co-living content there as well.
Follow us for more interviews with world's most influential business titans, providing you with the insights to awaken to your full potential so you can get paid to be yourself, find true happiness, and manifest anything you desire.